Good evening.
I'd like to call to order the May 23rd, 2017 meeting of the council committee of the whole. Gentlemen, you have before you an agenda for all three committees that will meet, and I'd like a motion to approve the overall agenda.
I make a motion, we accept the agenda.
Second. Been moved by Councilman Lewis and seconded by Councilman Neal to approve the agenda. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Each individual committee will approve their agenda as well. We're going to reorder things a little bit and go with the utility committee first. So, Councilman Cole.
Before you have the agenda for the utility committee, are there any additions or deletions? Can I get a motion?
Move.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
First item on the agenda is the Energy Authority presentation of electric utility integrated resource plan. Ms. Mitchell could please come up and introduce.
Thank you, Councilman Cole. As you know, we've been working on this integrated resource plan for some time. I'm happy to report it's done, and we have Mr. William Clark from the Energy Authority here to provide the presentation.
Welcome, Mr. Clark.
Thank you. Make sure it's on here. Kind of took me by surprise. I thought we were on the third on the agenda. I was like, whoa. First of all, let me say thank you for giving us a chance to present the IRP. This is a process that's been underway for, gosh, probably 9 months or so. It gives us a chance to talk through what we've done and how the report was prepared and the study was done. Before I get started, one thing I'd like to introduce a little bit is our team, those that are here already. As Donna said, my name is Bill Clark. I'm the Executive Director of Strategic Innovations and Analytics at the Energy Authority. This IRP was prepared under my management and guidance, along with myself, the key players, Lisa Dohan, who's a senior analyst with my team that was responsible for really pulling the whole thing together. We had a couple of other people on the team that did a lot of work back in Jacksonville, Johan Sajandra and Jim Fort. Also, Arlene Holloway is the energy manager for TEA and doing work with the city of Dover. And a lot of this work was done in a very close collaboration with Donna and with Harry Maloney. Without their help and input, I don't think we could have done this as successfully as we did. I think all of you have at least seen the report. It was presented or provided to you in the last couple of weeks, I think it was, so you had a chance to look at it. And the presentation today is really just taking a summation of that report. There's a lot of meat that's in the report that you can go to and if you need to. We went through a very extensive process that we'll talk about a little bit tonight. We'll talk about the study assumptions, summary of the results, and conclusions. And we will move shortly.
That way, the screen up front.
Which one?
That one
up there.
Yeah.
Over there?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm pushing. It is turned on. Let's try it again. There we go. Something's moving. All right. Sorry about that. I wasn't quite ready to jump up yet. The first couple of slides are really just an overview to somewhat set the levelization, if you will, for the overall project, what we did. The first here is just basically saying I think everybody knows electric power is a keystone to the nation's economic and social welfare. I think you can pretty much say when you look at the city of Dover that the electric utility and the production of electricity is key to the city and really to the United States in general. There's almost like a motherhood in the apple pie statement. What's more important is really when you look at the IRP, one of the things you need to take into consideration is how do the consumers really use the electricity, how do you pay for it, it's a critical commodity, and a lot of the power supply decisions and the economic lives measured in decades. The key here is that when you're looking at an IRP, you're looking at a 20-year or sometimes longer study. So you're looking out there trying to make decisions, looking at your sales, what they're going to be over the next 20 years, what regulations and laws are going to look like over the next 20 years, what's your generation that you have on site now, how it's going to run, how it's going to be maintained over the next 20, 30 years. And then also when you're looking at the market in general, saying, what's going to happen in the market? If you look at history and the volatility of the market, and especially like things like natural gas and various fuels, you're trying to take all of that into consideration and come up with a plan that makes the most sense and the least incremental cost to the customers, in this case, of the city of Dover. Again, existing supply is critical. And as you're looking at your existing supply, and in this particular case, you do have retirements being evaluated. So you're looking at not just what your existing existing facilities are, but what your replacement power is going to look like, where it's going to come from, what the operational considerations and characteristics are. And, of course, in today's world, you're also looking at demand-side management, ways in which you can manage your load better with your customers to either, you know, peak shave, energy reductions, or whatever. So all of these go in when we talk about an integrated resource plan. Integration means you're bringing supply side, demand side. You look at what your load is doing, your markets are doing. So it's trying to pull everything together, you know, into one study. As we started the project, we sat down with Harry and Donna and others here in the city of Dover and really walked through what are the key objectives that is important or are important to Dover. And one of the most important pieces here is an IRP process that is not just a one-time, you do it and you put it on the table and you walk away. This is a process that's an ongoing process. So the whole idea here was to develop an approach to how we could take what we know today, put together, you know, a report, a set of results, a recommendation, et cetera. But more importantly, what changes? You know, as you're looking down the road a piece, you know, things change on a regular basis. So, you know, how do you take this process and set it up so that it's repeatable? You don't want it to be a one-time shot. You want something that's repeatable. That's a very critical element. We wanted to make sure we have from a load forecasting, you know, energy and demand forecasting. There are, again, plenty of changes are going on out there in the industry. As you see, there's growth. You see volatility in the growth. There's volatility in things like how consumers use electricity. So as you're looking at, you know, a load forecast for the future, you're trying to accommodate growth, energy efficiency, utilization on a per capita basis, things like that. So you're trying to take the most current technology or approaches to doing this. Commodity, you know, you're looking at your market, your, you know, the different sources of energy. You're in a market called the PJM market. You know, being able to account for that, what's the future look like? Emissions are important. You know, as we all know, very recently we've had the issue around the Clean Power Plan that the EPA put forth. It's been put on hold for the time being. But when you're looking out 20 years, what's it going to really look like 20 years, you know, over the next 20 years? We know that things change in Washington, you know, and every time there's a change, there's a possibility of a change in regulations that's going to impact your emissions. So, again, you're trying to make projection of what the emissions are going to look like. When we talk about prices already from, you know, commodities such as natural gas, coal, oil, just the market price of power in general. New resources, because as you're looking at the potential of building something new, again, you're looking at something that it's not just today or tomorrow, but you've got, again, 20 years. What are the prices going to look like for new construction out there? What's the technologies that are going to be out there in the new generation resources? So you're trying to account for all of that also. The key what you're trying to get down to then is to build an optimal mix. So you're taking all of these uncertainties that you're, you know, that's out there in the future over the next 20 years, and you're trying to come out with a plan that says what is the best plan for the city of Dover, all things considered, when you're looking at all the different options. One of the things that was important, because PJM has a short-term capacity market that you can utilize when you're short a few megawatts in you know, each year, and it's a three-year rolling window out there. But what's important, we felt, was from the city of Dover, what's a good long-term strategy that you should have? And typically the long-term strategy means either buying or a self-build. Utilizing the short-term capacity market at PJM is okay on a short-term, but there's the potential for volatility, uncertainty, and by having your own resources, either through purchase resources or self-built resources, it's a hedge towards what the market's going to do down the road piece. So it's beneficial to have your own resources put caps on what your capacity prices are. And I think one of the most important things when you're all done with an IRP is having clear recommendations. I've been in this business 40 years, and I've seen a number of recommendations from various folks. They come out with very nice-sized, thick books that are becoming paperweights. You can't do anything. What's important here is having something that says, here's an action plan of what you should do, and it's very clear that the leadership of the city and the utility have something to move on. As I said before, It's a repeatable process, and without going through a lot of the diagram here, but the key here is you start with a projection of what your customers are going to be doing, what your load going to look like over the next 20 years. And then from there, you know, you look at your existing resources, you look at what your goals are for the city, what's the need for new resources, et cetera. So you go through this whole process. When you get all the way down to that green box kind of to the right and the bottom, you know, it's to folks like yourself to review and agree and approve the plan, whatever that plan happens to be. But that's not the end of it. It loops back as you get more information and you go right back into the, you know, development of the new plan. So, you know, when we first started talking about this with the staff at the utility, we're looking at probably, you know, a 2-year cycle roughly. You know, they don't need to be done every year, but if you wait too long, too many changes occur. Let's go into some of the key assumptions here. One of the first parts that's it's definitely important is reliability and maintaining a level of reliability for the city, for, you know, the utility, and keeping electricity and the lights on. Obviously, you know, from your customer's perspective, high reliability, lights on, being able to flip that switch, it's highly critical, you know, to the customer satisfaction. Along with that is keeping costs down. So how do you keep your electricity costs down as you look at, you know, your utility going forward? And when you have such uncertainty and you're building, you know, trying to plan for the future, you got to balance the cost along with the resource requirements. When you're looking at new technologies and new options to, you know, particularly say a self-build, because of the size of the city of Dover, more often than not, you're looking at potentially new resources for self-build that to get the more efficient size and cost, you need to build something that would be greater than what your specific needs are. So you need to look at, you know, what are all, you know, if you build something that you need, say, 50 megawatts, but your best option to say 100 megawatts, you need to look at alternatives for what you're going to, you know, offset that at 50 for and offload it in some, you know, some other quarters, other customers or utilities or something like that. So those are the primary objectives. We talk about uncertainties. Going into the major assumptions, as we said before, it's driven by the load forecast. So all things considered, we looked at a 20-year load forecast that we did actually about a year or so ago. And what we see is, in general, the load is flat. Your peak demand here in Dover is flat. Now, you've got growth going on through new construction, things like that, but what you're seeing out there in the industry is customer efficiency has improved and continues to improve. You know, you look at it from a perspective of, you know, your large customers such as the large box stores like Walmarts and Kmarts and places like that, they're constantly finding ways to keep their efficiency up and continuing to increase that through improved HVAC facilities, improved lightings, you know, things like that. Of course, on the customer side, your residential customers are always looking for ways, you know, you replace your HVAC system with a higher SEER system, you're looking for, you know, you've gone from incandescent to now LEDs. Appliances. You know, I know in my case, I just replaced my refrigerator and went from one that was 15 years old to a new one, and already you're seeing such higher efficiency on them. So even though you're seeing an increase in customers, that utilization per customer is tapering off. So as you're looking for the long term, you're seeing a very flat load when you're going through the next 20 years. And this is a hard one to read if you're at a distance. I apologize for that. But this is basically looking at your existing resources. So right now, that's available for you to use over the next 20 years. You've got the McKee Run. It's a steam unit put in 1975. Right now, the planned retirement is 2027. And it's about 102 megawatts of capacity that's accounted for in the city. Van Zandt is the combustion turbine put in 92. Right now, it has a planned retirement of 2041. Now, to get to 2041, we're actually looking at about a $2.1 million life extension opportunity here, where if you don't spend the 2.1, you'd have to retire it in 2021. So you're gaining 20 years by that $2.1 million. Now, one of the questions that we had was, is that a good investment? Does it make sense to spend $2.1 million, you know, basically over the next 12 to 18, 24 months, to get a 20-year extension of life of the Van Zandt unit? So we studied that. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. Of course, you got your Sun Park, which we rounded up into 10 megawatts. Really, it's a 9.3, if I remember correctly, of what it's really capable of. So that's your existing resources right now. And as you're looking at it, when you think of the next 20 years, you see, again, McKee Run, that's a 2027 retirement date, the potential for Van Zandt going out 2021. So when you go to this page, this is the existing resources that you have today. You've got a 40-megawatt capacity purchase that goes out through 2023. Then you've got McKee that could retire in 2027 or end of 2026. And then you got Van Zandt that we've made the assumption in the base case that it goes out to 2041. Now, this one will drive you nuts because it's very busy, but it gives you, and we talk about whether we do one slide for each of these charts, but I wanted to show you side by side what this looks like. So in schedule number one, that's the retirement base case. So that's our base plan that says in 2024, your 40 megawatts of capacity purchase goes away. In 2027, your McKee Run retires. But there is the potential, like I said, for changes such as the Van Zandt. So what you see in retirement schedule two, Van Zandt retires in 2021, and you continue McKee, or no, I take the bet. They all retire. So you've got the Van Zandt going out in 2021, you've got the 40 megawatts of capacity purchase goes away in 2024, and McKee Run goes out in 2027. The idea being there is from an efficiency and manpower perspective, if you know, the suggestion is that if you take out Van Zandt, do you take out everything? And then the last one, and I will apologize, I'm getting ahead of myself. So schedule two is Van Zandt in 21 and McKee Run in 27 versus schedule three, which is both Van Zandt and McKee Run in 21. So what I'm trying to get to here is three different retirement schedules to look at a base plan and two alternative plans given the age and condition of the units and then the life extension opportunity for you. From this perspective, this is when you're looking at potentially new resources. So you've got a number of different resources we looked at. All of these, with the exception of solar, are natural gas. We looked at the regulations right now around coal, and we said, you know, we're not going to go coal, we're not going to go oil. So really, you're looking at different types of technologies and natural gas. That is the most likely future for the generation additions. And you've got different technologies here, like the first one is a natural gas combined cycle, which is a couple of combustion turbines connected to a heat recovery steam generator. So you've got multiple ways in which the generation occurs. Then you've got things like the NGCT, which is a natural gas combustion turbine. Frame is a type of a technology. You've got RICE, which is the reciprocating internal combustion engine. And then you've got a potential for a photovoltaic solar option out there. One of the keys that you look at here is you can see the size, and that goes back to the point that I made before that really, from Dover's perspective, you need about, say, 40 to 50 megawatts of capacity in the early years. So in each of these technologies, you're looking that you're going to have to do some off-putting of some amount of the capacity to, you know, other places, other utilities. The last column there is what we call a contribution to peak capacity. So in the PJM market, they look at and say how much of your generation capacity accounts towards the obligation. So when you think about the market the way you have is you take your load plus a reserve to give you a total obligation. Well, you have to have then generation that's available to meet that total obligation. In typical fossil units such as the gas-fired units, what you're saying that the 50 megawatts is you can account towards that 50 megawatts of obligation. Solar, like a renewable, because it doesn't operate all the time, you know, when the sun goes out, goes down, you know, you're no longer generating solar. At night, you're not generating solar. Cloud goes overhead. So from PJM's perspective, they say that basically it's about a 38% ratio. So whatever capacity you put in, you get about 38% to your obligation. So that's why we have a 30-megawatt solar out there, but you're only getting 11 megawatts to meet your obligation. From the bottom one is a purchase power option, which is looking out to the marketplace and saying, on the top of the chart, it's self-build. Dover builds these, makes the investment, and has them out there, and you know, you own and build. The other one is a purchase power option, so you go out to the market and see what somebody's willing to provide you. much like the 40 megawatts you have currently with the Calpine unit. One of the keys here is that as we look at a capacity purchase, we had assumed that it would be some type of a, we use pricing basically on some type of a new unit. Since you don't really know what the market's going to do, you're making your best guesses, so we put a premium on there of 10%. It's just, you know, conditions for markups, premium, you know, prices, transmission, whatever. So it's a little bit higher than what, you know, a new build would have been. One of the keys through here, which will really play out as you get into the conclusions and recommendations, is our numbers here are our best guesses from what you've seen in the market. There are multiple ways in which you can get cost to construct or cost for purchase power. For cost to construct, usually means going out with an RFP to an AE firm to come up with a detailed design. That's not what we're doing for the IRP. This is indicative cost based on what we're seeing in the industry at other IRPs and talking to other utilities. Same with the purchase power is, you know, it's one of those where we're making our best guesses. So as you that'll keep that in mind as you're getting into the recommendations going forward. Sometimes a little slow. The key here is you can build a base plan with your best guess of fuel, your best guess of market prices, your best guess of what's going to go on with the greenhouse gas regulations, what's going to go on with renewable portfolio standards. But that's all your best guess. But you, what you're looking for is a plan that can come out and say, what about fuel prices change if natural gas goes up or goes down, which is difficult where it is right now, but definitely you've seen much higher gas prices. What happens if gas goes up? Also, in the region, we've got renewable portfolio standards, which is the amount of renewables that a city requires, you know, that you have to have installed. Right now, it's at 25% by 2025. What happens if it goes up? So you need more renewables to meet regulations. And then the wild card out there is carbon. What's going to happen out there in regulations? You know, as I said earlier, you've got stayed right now at the EPA, but again, 4 years, 8 years, 12 years down the road, things can change. And so we made an assumption that they will change, they will go up, and so we wanted a plan here that would be fitting across all five of those different scenarios. So one last piece to kind of help you as we move into the modeling. Whoops. When you look at the incremental costs from power supply over the next 20 years, there are a variety of pieces that play into this. So you can see sort of the center line there at zero. Anything above zero is a cost. Anything below zero is revenue. And when you're looking at the market today, there are a variety of ways in which the markets will cost you, and there are a variety of ways in which you'll receive revenue from the markets. You know, for instance, when you look at in PJM market, you are buying the energy from PJM. PJM will charge you for that. Whenever your generation is running, PJM will give you revenue for that. So there's a variety of ways out there. There's also, when you look at building your own facility, there's a debt service charge. You know, you've got to repay the investment. So those are costs. In a purchase power environment, there are revenue sources also from the marketplace. So the point here is just you can see the variety of revenues and costs that all played into, in this case, the base plan. Very small numbers here, very hard to read, but the thing to zero in on is that sort of the yellow or orange line there. What that is, first of all, you can see here across at the top is you are a lifesaver. Thank you. Appreciate that. So as you can see, this is retirement schedule one, and you can see across the top there are five scenarios that we talked about, and then coming down the left side are a variety of different resource optimization schedules. You can see different ways in which we combine solar or the purchase power or self-build options. And these were really just a fraction of all the cases we ran under that retirement schedule one. These were the top plans. But the point to make on this screen is, again, the yellow or orange line going across, says that that particular plan, which is a combination of purchase power and solar, was the actual lowest price across all of the scenarios studied. And that's what you're looking for in a recommended plan, is what plan holds up across all of the uncertainties that you see in the future. And that's the plan that worked for the retirement one. We had a similar plan, a little bit different because you have more need for capacity in retirement schedule two. But again, the plan that came out was a mixture of solar and purchase power. And it was the lowest cost across all the different options. And the same with this one. So what they had told us, when you look at these three retirement schedules and all of the plans that we studied, the recommendation comes out to a mixture of purchase power and solar. And so that made the most economic sense from an incremental present value revenue requirements perspective, which is the key that is, that you're what you're looking for is the lowest natural or net present value revenue requirements. So what that told us was we had a pretty good plan out there. There was various timings and amounts of capacity, but again, if you're looking at those are the best mixes of solar and purchase power. And from this one, this goes into looking at the retirement, you know, the best plan in each of the retirement schedules. And what you're trying to get to is where you see 18,672, 17,529. That's showing that the retirement schedule of Van Zandt in 2041 versus a 2021, it's more expensive to retire Van Zandt now than it is the $2.1 million investment. So for $2.1 million now, you're saving, depending on the conditions that we see in the future, typically, you know, $11 to $45 million over the study period, except for one case where it's a loss of 4.2, but when you see basically 10 different, you know, situations there, nine of which shows that life extension makes the most sense. So we felt very strongly and very, very confidently that spending the $2.1 million today for the extension to 2041 makes good economic sense. Now, just as a disclaimer, you know, we did not review what went into that 2.1. We're not an engineering firm, but in talking to the staff at City of Dover, we felt like they, you know, they've done a good job of looking at what the numbers are, and for what we saw at this point in time, we felt like from an economic perspective, it does make sense. This is just a graphical representation of the table that we just saw a minute ago, so it really doesn't say anything different. It just shows from a bar chart instead of a tabular.
Good question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. I just have a question about the $11 million, $14 million versus the $2.1 million. Did you say earlier that $11 to $14 million in present value?
Net present value, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your inflation and everything's already calculated in there.
And that's an excellent question, because in the process for the economics, we had an escalation rate in there, I want to say it was roughly 2%, I think it was, and then a discount rate coming back about 3.6%. So everything in the future was escalated and then discounted back.
Thank you.
Yeah. But I appreciate the question. From what you're seeing in the numbers right now, you are seeing that the purchase power at this stage of the game, with what we know, is the lowest cost option as opposed to a self-build. But there are risks. If you take purchase power and retire your units, you know, not all of them obviously right away, but over time, there is a risk not having generation in the city, you know, that's owned by the City of Dover. You know, there's a question about backup generation for Dover should an event occur, such as a transmission outage and things like that where you don't have generation on. You know, so there is a need really to look at that qualitative risk and the potential for, you know, reliability impacts. That said, though, there is a third-party generator tied very tightly or closely to the Dover transmission system. So there is some generation out there besides Dover, but again, you need to really take a look at this. And from the transmission perspective, this was not a transmission study, but I would say that we'd highly recommend talking about a transmission system analysis to make sure that as you're reducing your generation and you're purchasing from outside, making sure from a transmission perspective that things work, from a reliability perspective. On the other side, when you have your own generation, there are risks also. So you've got to look at balancing the risks. You know, in the PJM market, when you're selling the capacity to PJM, there are performance standards. So when PJM calls on the unit and they, expecting to be there, and it's not there for some reason, which is always a risk when you own equipment, there's a penalty or a fine assessed by PJM. So that is a negative side out there. And of course, when you look at rotating machinery and the technologies that are out there, there's always the risk of unexpected, unplanned outages. So there are balances of risks when you're looking at either a purchase power or your own generation. From a driver's perspective, when you look at what's driving the answers, again, you're looking at the cost of new generation resources. We are making our best analysis around the numbers that we know. Those numbers drive the answer, obviously. So as you're looking at different technologies, we looked at and said, a large combined cycle that might come, you buy a part of from a purchase power agreement versus a smaller combined cycle that you might do a self-build, the larger units have more efficiency, typically have lower costs, installed costs. So again, you're looking at these are the cost assumptions that, again, are going to be driving the answer. The larger units tend to be more efficient. The heat rates tend to be lower, meaning they're more economical to run from the market's perspective, call down more often. So there's more opportunity for revenues to come in from those other units, from a higher efficiency unit. What we found, though, in the results, when you see going across all of the scenarios, changes in gas prices, changes in the carbon constraints, changes in the renewable portfolio standards really didn't have an impact. So we felt like, again, our recommendation really does fit very well with the uncertainties of the future. Conclusions. We really feel that the extension of the unit, Van Zandt, makes a lot of sense, pushing off the retirement until the later dates. Purchase power agreements of 40 megawatts and installation of 30 megawatts of solar, based on everything we know right now, is really the most economical assumption or outcome for the 2024 capacity shortage. So you're looking at, that's going to give you roughly 50 megawatts of installed capacity between the 40 megawatts of the PPA and that 30 megawatts of solar. That really gives you about 11 megawatts of capacity in the PJM market. And then in the later year, 2027, again, about another 100 megawatts of capacity is needed. A mixture of solar and purchase power. So from a recommendation perspective, one of the keys here is, as we said earlier, this is based on our best analysis of what the numbers look like. Since you don't need anything until really 2024, you've got a window of opportunity here. You're talking 7 years until something needs to come into play. And when you look at whether it be a new facility, a self-build, that requires really today's technologies and today's permitting all, roughly 4 to 5 years in greenfield versus brownfield site, or purchase power has a narrower window when you need to go out for an RFP. Our recommendation really is you've got a couple of years in here, 1 to 2 years of a window for an RFP process to really go out and fine-tune or hone in on the numbers. Look at what the market is willing to do, through a turnkey self-build type of option, to see what what the prices really are going to be when you get somebody to put pen to paper and really sharpen their pencil. And a purchase power agreement. Again, we're making best of what we know from our market activities, but when you're going out for a long-term capacity purchase, you're wanting somebody that's going to, put a contract in front of you that you could sign. So you want hard numbers to be able to do that. So our recommendation really is to go out for a purchase power agreement, RFP, to look at, you know, a 30 megawatts of solar that could either be a self-build or a purchase power agreement. And then the last piece is looking at a self-build, probably a combustion turbine or a the RICE technology, which is the reciprocating internal combustion engine. We do recommend the second RFP for 2027, and we really recommend looking at a diversified combination of vendors. Don't look at just one or two vendors. Really, you know, look to the marketplace to see what's out there. There are a variety of ways in which you can bring in both the solar and the gas fire technologies. Look what's out there and really, you know, take your time over the next year or two to really hone in and firm these numbers up. Standard disclaimer. And gives you a chance to ask all kinds of questions and be gentle.
First of all, Mr. Clark, I want to thank you for your presentation. Mr. Sudler, I think, has a question, then Mr. New.
Thank you again.
Sure.
In regards to the numbers, the estimation of numbers that you know from the city, what numbers or variables that was not given in the city's equation may affect your recommendation towards a different position that could affect the future RFP request?
What numbers that were not, so assumptions in the study that were not given to us by the city?
Correct, that you may have seen in other scenarios from okay. other cities that we could consider that may affect our request.
I think the numbers that were our numbers, okay, that we generated were market prices, fuel prices, and costs of new capacity. So those are the ones that were provided by us, where and also I think the load forecast was done for the city by us. So a lot of what you're seeing out there, it was numbers that were generated by us, which is why the city hired us, is because, you know, that's the type of work that, you know, we would do. What you saw from basically, they all those assumptions could have an impact on an RFP. And what we found, though, was that when you look at those market conditions, the uncertainties, this plan, and I hate to use the term robust, it's kind of a cliche in the industry, but this plan is pretty robust across all of those uncertainties. They can have an impact on the answer, on the RFP, but we also feel that given where we are, we feel very strongly that won't have a change in the recommendation.
Thank you.
Councilman Neal.
In the fog of electric forecasting, I'm thinking in terms of solar, because you said 30 watts or whatever, it comes down to 11, what have you. Now, I do know that the solar panels themselves have improved tremendously as part as opposed to the sun park behind us, behind my community. But in any case, the other thing is that we are supposed to have reserved in the area of where Civic Center was supposed to be a section of land for additional solar power. Was that considered in this, and what would improvements in solar technology bring to the table?
First, from the improvement of technologies of solar, we did consider, we recently went through a research, if you will, around the cost of solar, and what we put into the study is probably the most current numbers and projections of what solar costs, install costs are going to be. So we've seen, just as you described, is a very dramatic reduction in a cost per unit of solar. And so we see it continuing to drop also. And it's dropped over the last, I don't know how many years, to a fraction, probably 20% or less of what some of the earlier numbers we saw. Now, as far as your specific land, we didn't really look at specific land here in the city. We know that from work that we've done in other locations that you get about, it takes about 8 acres per megawatt of capacity. So as you're looking at 30 megawatts, multiply that times 8, and you can see the amount of acreage that you need to do a city facility. So we didn't look at any specific land areas, but you can kind of start to see the amount of land that's going to be necessary for something like this. And so you may even look at, you know, a partial built by the city and a partial from a purchase power. Take the land that you've got or the surrounding community areas that, you know, farmland that may be available or undeveloped land. That answer your question?
Well, we'll see what kind of land we're talking about. But it was, I think, in our plans to do that for a section of the land. Again, that had to be you know, landfill type of land that was there and available.
Right.
And some of that land has going to be turned over. I don't know how official we are to the Delaware State University, but there was a whole section that was supposed to be open or held for the sole purpose of solar panels. So we'll see.
And I think that's an excellent opportunity to use that land for, if not all of the 30 that's recommended here in the first set. Maybe partial of it. So.
Thank you, sir.
Councilman Slavin.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that, on your modeling for the 30 megawatts of solar, that include the possible land acquisition cost?
There is a portion of land. This was somewhat industry standard numbers, and so we didn't have exact amount of land that's in these industry numbers, but if you can see, you know, we made an assessment and said how much on the net present value basis for each $1 million of extra cost for land, you can see that there's about a fraction of that, you know, like 80 to 90% of that actually shows up in the net present value. That would have an impact here. But we didn't look at your individual land costs. Again, not knowing your land, and we felt like that was not really part of the study, and I didn't want to get into crosswise with your real estate folks.
All right. So I'll go back to my original question. First of all, thank you for your study, and my thanks to your. And thank you to Mrs. Mitchell for pursuing this. She's one who has said, you know, before we make any decisions, we should really kind of take a long view like this and kind of broaden the lens. And I think it's, for me, it's very helpful. Now, all that said, I will tell you that, you know, I've been at this for a little while, and at my very best, I'm not very good at this stuff, right? This is not what I do for. I'm a part-time legislator on this city council, as are all my colleagues, and none of us, I believe, are in the utilities and the energy business. So in that 20-year forecast, you may see key decision makers, such as this body here, turn over to maybe 3 full times.
Right.
And I know that that's probably not dissimilar to other industries, but I think what is that the knowledge transfer in this line of work is almost non-existent. Right? Someone gets unelected, and that's it. They take the knowledge with them. So can you kind of speak to the risk that's involved with what we inherit as risk, and that's what I feel, is that we have an awful lot of risk in being asked to make decisions about a very complicated set of issues, which we're not conversant in, which we're not, you know, we don't have kind of a deeper dive of knowledge in. We rely on experts and we rely on consultants,
right.
But the thing that wakes me up in the middle of the night is, well, who vets the information that we're getting from the experts? Who vets the information that we're getting from the consultants? Not to disparage anything that you or anyone else is saying, but how do we know? So maybe you can just comment on that.
Well, and that's a fair question. And I have had the opportunity to be on the other side of the tables receiving from the consultants over the years. And so I understand the same questions that you've got. And part of the problem with a 20-year plan, as you say, not only do you get turnover, there's so much uncertainty out there. And you can make a plan today, and things could change, you know, that are outside even the assumptions that we've put in place here. Fortunately, I think, with, you know, one of the things you have to fall back on, I think, is folks like Ms. Mitchell and Mr. Maloney that can come together and help guide you folks, you know, and hopefully, you know, they're taking what we're saying and they're taking it with a questioning eye also and challenging what we're doing and asking us a lot of the questions so that they feel comfortable that what we're telling them, and they then concur to you, that you feel confident that, you know, you're getting good answers. But there is a risk because you're taking on a decision today for something that's going to be out there for 20 years. And many of these these plans that you put in place. Like if you do a self-build, it's out there for 30 years. So you have to know the risk that you're taking on, but you also have to know the risk of not taking that plan on. Because if you don't take the plan on and you don't have the generation to meet your load, your costs are going to go up. Your reliability could suffer. So it's important to, you know, question, challenge, ask the questions, you know, look to your staff for support, and move forward.
Thank you.
Councilman Ames.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have three questions right now. One is, when it comes to the McKee plant, which we're looking at retiring in a few years, probably mm-hmm. about 7 years. How long does it take to build a new plant and bring it on board with the regulations that exist? When would it have to start? If we did it, what would be the timeline for a decision on that and for bringing it up to speed? Because that's about 100 megawatt there?
McKee Run is about 102 megawatts of net capacity. And you're right. Right now it's looking at a 2027 potential retirement.
It's 102 watts of net capacity. We really don't use it that much.
It runs very seldom right now. Part of it is because of the cost, the operating cost of it, and the fuel availability and things like that. And when you're looking at it, it's the PJM market that calls on it when it needs. And my understanding is it just was called on in the last few days to operate for a few hours. So, but it's there for a hedge against the market conditions. So to not have something out there that you've got a long-term ownership of, whether it be purchase power or your own generation, would put you at risk from an uncertainty of what the future market prices are. To answer your question, though, from a time frame, we're looking right now, depending on the technology and the size, but if you look at a greenfield, meaning, you know, a brand new site, permitting, ordering, construction, all that, you're probably looking 4 or 5 years is roughly what we're seeing on average right now.
And so that would even be with when we're replacing an existing plant. So it would still be about 4 to 5 years?
Well, you've got to, you know, if you're going to use the site that you, say McKee, for instance, if you were to retire McKee, demolish it, and then rebuild on its site, you would probably add time to that. But you're probably better off, you know, taking other land and using it. It might be considered a brownfield site that's maybe part of your facility, or looking at a different site. But again, I can't sit there and tell you how long it would take to do a demolition of an existing facility, or a cost to do that. I mean, I've seen some around in the industry, and it's, you know, it can't take time. But if you look at a brand new greenfield site, you're probably talking, again, 4 to 5 years. And so you've got a couple of years of window here before you actually have to pull that trigger and make that decision.
Next is it's a little bit of a, what is the unforced capacity obligation? Could you explain that a little better, please? It was a little unclear to me in your paperwork.
The unforced capacity? I think what you're talking about there is when you're looking at a unit, it may have a capacity limitation of, say, 100 megawatts, but it's actually tested and looked at your capability in a real-world condition. And, you know, so there are going to be unplanned outages through equipment failures and things like that. And so when the market is looking at it, it says it may have a nameplate of 100, let's say, but because of testing and market conditions, or not market, but, you know, operational conditions, it may only be worth, say, 90, 95, that the market will actually consider towards your obligation.
Okay. And finally, when it comes to this particular plant that we're looking at retiring, because if we bring a new plant on board, it's, of course, much more likely that it's going to be able to operate efficiently and more often, it will have a higher efficiency and therefore could possibly get called upon more. How would that affect the trade-offs? Would we need as much of a capacity with a plant that with the new plant?
Yeah, there's two different concepts there that we're talking about. One is capacity, which is necessary to meet the obligations of PJM. So when you sit there and look at a unit that may be a 50 megawatts of capacity, that is 50 megawatts towards your obligation. So if you go back to what I mentioned earlier, where you've got, say, 100 megawatts of load and a 16% reserve requirement, you need 116 megawatts. And so you need that capacity to reach that 116. But once you've got the capacity, then the market is looking for the energy from it. And so it's looking to say, from an economics perspective, how economical and efficient is your plant compared to everything else in the marketplace? And it's going to call on your plant. And you're right, a new unit compared to the existing unit is going to be more efficient and most likely going to be called on a lot more than your existing facilities. But that's to produce the energy that's going to, the market's going to buy from you, and it becomes a revenue source for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Any more questions from the committee? Mr. Blayton.
I got a handful.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
Move weird.
On the comment of a revenue source, it would not. It would offset having to purchase power because you're not running, and when you bring your generation on, you're going to consume the electricity and you won't have it to sell. You won't have to buy it, but you'll be generating and using it on your own system. Unless, you know, there's a price difference large enough to offset the purchase.
Well, in today's RTO market environment, the market is dictating what generation is going to be generated when and how much.
For the whole.
But you're part of the whole.
Yeah.
And so when you're looking at it, you're balancing. The market is sitting there saying, Dover, as well as the rest of the PJM market, needs so much energy to serve its load. And so you are buying from the market to serve your city of Dover load. On the other side, if you've got generation that's running more, that's a revenue source. So in a situation where your units may support you on the capacity side to meet your obligations, if it's not running, it's not getting revenue from the market, but your load is getting a charge from the market. So by having a unit that runs more, that's more energy that's being served or sold to the market, and it is a pure revenue source then.
So does it go to the market first, or does it go to the Dover system first?
Well, it's electronics. I mean, electrons, but you know, at the end of the day, it goes to the market first, so the market is buying, and you're buying from the market. So from a financial perspective, a dollar flow, the market is giving you dollars for revenue and taking dollars from you on a cost. So the electrons may locate here, but from a settlement perspective, a dollar flow perspective, you're getting revenue from the market and you're getting a charge from the market. And it doesn't matter where it's generated. It's like think of a big pond, and there's people taking water out of the pond and there's people putting water in the pond. And that's the way the electricity market is.
Back to the quantitative page 25 of the report. Risk of having no generation OPPA. System-wide outage can cause a problem for the city they like to back up. I have 43 years of experience with the City of Dover Electric Department, 50 or 33 of them actually working for it, and the rest being around. Only two times in our history have we relied on the City of Dover. Back in the 50s, when a bright-eyed operator at the St. John's power plant saw Delmarva going down and separated and kept the city on. And then when they had the East Coast blackout, we were able to get back on before the rest of the system got on. So that's two times out of 40-some years where it has been an issue.
Is there a question or just?
No, just okay. A statement.
Okay. And I won't argue that point.
I'm not concerned because while we talk about being a big concern, in actuality, it's not been a big issue for the city of Dover.
And I won't argue that point. It's just a point to be aware of,
yeah.
And to think about. It's may not be a driver, but it's a point.
But if we go all purchase power, all these variables and uncertainties we talk about, pretty much go away except for the purchase power cost. Because now you're just buying power, you don't have generation.
Correct.
Okay, so you're down to one variable.
Right, and by getting a long-term contract, you're trying to minimize the uncertainty around that variable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you get rid of a whole lot of uncertainties, and you try to deal with one remaining certainty by contracting out. So that's not a bad position to be in.
I would agree. My only encouragement is at least have something that you own, whether it be a purchase power agreement that's got
long
or steel in the ground.
Yeah,
but you'd have to owning steel in the ground someplace else, or owning steel in the ground here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That can work out. Back on page 26, recommend strategies not affected significantly by the sensitivity study for high gas, low gas prices, which in the second report, one of the largest sources of risk on a forward basis for any thermal unit is the cost and availability of fuel.
Yes.
Why is that not true for that statement? Why is it negligible and for that particular state?
I'm trying to figure out what page are you looking at?
Page 25.
Oh, 25.
26 of the drivers. You're talking about recommended strategies not affected significantly by the restrictive study for high gas prices, low gas prices, and more. But then on page 73 of the second part of the report, you make the statement that the largest risk is fuel prices. Why is that statement true, but not for that recommendation?
Well, I think in general, one of the most volatile assumptions in here is fuel. And I think that's a key point. But at the same time, when you're looking at the recommendations right now, it's not a driver. You're seeing low gas, base gas, and high gas, and it's still coming out with the same answer.
Because you got a relatively small portion of that relying on gas for fuel.
I'm not sure I say it's relatively small, but I mean it's
well, if it's variable,
yeah.
It's not a big impact. Something's got to
yeah.
Make
I mean, I think what you're really seeing here is probably from the recommendations. It's coming out more of the capital costs and the efficiency assumptions of the units, how
yeah.
it uses the fuel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you look at that, then the gas prices don't have a big impact.
Right.
I think we pretty much covered that one.
You're well prepared.
I had a good weekend. To make up for the capacity shortfall in 2024, it is recommended that an RFP be issued for 50 megawatts of capacity to firm up the IRP pricing and cost comparisons. Options for these RFPs should be included. Purchase power agreement and installation of 30 megawatts of solar photovoltaic. That one was already talked about, but somewhere you're missing about 200, 250 acres to do that.
If you were to build solar yourself,
yeah.
Well, whoever builds solar.
It's going to take 250 acres.
About, yeah, 8 acres per megawatt of capacity. Yeah. Yeah. So
you have to have that 250 acres. Self-building gas turbine or rice, which I had to print out so I could know what it was, reciprocating internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be a diesel unit or a gas-fired unit? Or
it's gas-fired.
Gas-fired?
Yeah.
Which leads to the next question, if we're doing all this gas firing, how are we getting gas?
And that's a good question, because one of the concerns we had in here was if you build your own, you for your existing units, the assumptions we went in here with was because it doesn't run very often, your gas supply is sufficient. But if you put in something new that probably has a higher efficiency and can run more, there's going to be a need for a more firm gas supply. So part of what we put in here is a cost for basically a higher cost for firm transfer of the gas. So we're making the assumption you can get it in. It'll be a cost to accommodate that. So we've not done I know as a company we've looked at what we can get in the way of gas. We feel we can, and we feel that the cost we put in here is a reasonable cost for that gas capacity.
We haven't been able to get sufficient firm gas to run Unit 3 at the plant. And Calpine, when they built, had to pay to have a private pipeline
right.
built.
And
so the gas
yes.
availability could become an issue.
And I think that, and that's a fair concern. I mean, we've put an assumption in here that we can get gas into the city, and that, you know, we feel like there's a premium that we put on the price to do that. But until you actually go out and you know, go for the gas, you're not going to know if you're going to get it. But we tried to accommodate the uncertainty by putting dollars on it.
Dollars on it.
Yeah. That's the best way you do it at this stage of the game.
And you probably have the best insight for what dollars to put on it. So I have a question about that. Oh, I got to ask this. Similarly, as recommended, and a second RFP is issued for the 2027 Tranche. Okay. I looked it up. What's your definition?
It's just an amount of supply. It's basically, from our perspective, just saying you've got one tranche, which is the 2024, and the other one's 2027. It's just a block of...
A part of...
Yeah. It's just a block of capacity that we recommend you go for.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure I understood it. That's that one. Sorry. Electric utilities must both generation capacity resources and the ability to provide electric energy instantaneously to service retail customers. Do they have to have generation?
Well, you have to have generation someplace, either your own or purchase power, yes.
Okay, because we got eight other municipals. Systems that don't have or have very little generation.
But they have contracts for it from someplace else.
Yeah. Yeah. They're operating on the purchase power.
Right. Business. Through DMAC or for whatever, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Mitigates all the other issues.
Yeah.
There were some numbers that were kind of scary. capacity, market association, uncertainties of supply and demand balance, various south prices for the DP&L Southern Zone, which Dover is in, range from a low of $2.51 per megawatt day to a high of $245 a megawatt day over the last 5 years. What's the trend on that? Is it trending from the two to the 400s, or?
I think we're looking at a trend that is probably going to go up. How much, we don't know.
Okay. Big numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah. The maximum price for auction is 1.5 times the net cost of new entry, or $394 a megawatt day for upcoming BRA. That wasn't on your synopsis list.
Yeah, base residual auction, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
We missed one of those.
it's hard to believe. 245 megawatt day over the last 5 years. And we're talking about it's probably going to go up, not down.
Yes, it's oscillating. I mean, it's very volatile, but I think, you know, the expectation over the
like
long term.
Like everything else in the world,
right,
is going up. Dover's actual annual locational reliability charge could have ranged from $165,000 to $61.5 million. Why is that such a wide variable?
I'm going to look to Lisa for that one.
She's my numbers person.
It's always good to have a numbers person.
Yes.
I couldn't let you sit back here.
She thought you were going to go the whole time.
Yeah, I did.
Can you just state your name, too, please, for the...
What's your name?
My name is Lisa Doheim. I'm an employee or an analyst at the Energy Authority. That number is based upon the auction is what people submit to cover their costs, right? And it's also the available capacity in PJM and for you guys in your zone itself. And so that can vary as to what they accept and what's available.
So we would anticipate the Calpine...
It has a cap to it as the cost of, it's called the CONE, so it's cost of new entry. So there is a cap to it, but...
Large cap.
A large cap, right. People submit their bids into the auction to cover their fixed costs. Because they need, they're trying to recover those.
Another big number.
Huge.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I got just one more, maybe.
I told her she's going to have to get up for one.
Risk factors to consider, page 72 to 75 of the second report. regulatory and certain environmental regulations, constraints, market risk, capacity markets, ancillary services, future developments, technology risk, and resource flexibility. Which of those are the biggest issues, one or two big issues that we need to be worried about?
I think one of the biggest uncertainties right now is the whole regulatory risk out there. You know, what's going to go on in the federal government over the next 20 years? I would put mine there from emissions type of perspective.
This is an unfair question I'm asking. For the new technology, is there anything on the back burners that are being developed now that may end up being a big game changer as far as generation and supply of electricity?
You're going to get a number of different opinions on that, I think. I think one of the biggest things out there that could really have an impact, a game changer, if you will, for the industry is storage. I think when you look at right now between wind and solar, rooftop solar or large solar facilities, you know, you've got limitations out there. But you get a storage capability tied to that of a utility grade along with the solar and the wind, to me that's a game changer.
And they're working hard on that technology now.
Yes. And you're at the early stages of it right now. You've got the guys like everybody knows, like Tesla and places like that. You've got places like California that is mandating so much storage going in and the different types of storage. You know, and this is all total conjecture and stuff like that. You're just guessing out there. But my personal opinion is if you can perfect utility-grade storage, it changes the game a lot.
My favorite saying is, the sun doesn't shine and wind doesn't blow. You can't use renewable energy. You have to have power plants.
Until you got a place to store it.
Until you got a place to store it.
Yeah. You look out in California, they talk about a thing called the duck curve, which is we've got so much of these renewables that you've backed off all your fossils in the middle of the day. Then you got a steep climb, and, you know, once the sun starts to go down, and you got to rely back on your fossil. But if you can flatten that out through storage.
Yeah.
And the other thing I can sit there and say from a utility perspective, you got to be ready to be part of it. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I think I've heard that opinion before. Okay, thank you. That's cleared a lot up.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
I'm glad I could help.
Thank you. Councilman Poof.
I only have 35 questions for you. I'm joking. As the new guy on council,
okay.
I appreciate the information. And one of my biggest questions, and it perhaps was out of the scope of the project as a whole, but even anecdotally, if you could comment, the goal is to, of course, reduce costs, create greater sustainability, and overall, what is the impact? And again, anecdotes is fine. Overall, what is the impact you've seen on economies? If you're able to reduce the burden on some of your large economic drivers, have you seen historically through any of the work that you've done in the past impact on local economies in the attraction or the retention of your economic drivers?
I think the general answer is obviously yes. If you can keep your cost drivers down in helping the local economy. From an anecdotal perspective, I can go back to days when I was assistant GM for a municipal utility in Indiana, not much different than this one. And if we could keep our costs down, we were able to attract more commercial and industrial customers. So, but there's always the balance. How do you balance the cost between the C&I versus the residential? So you got to keep your best balance. But anytime you can, as a community, manage the cost to your users of your commodity, that's going to help you grow your customer base. That was it? I went for 34 more.
Be careful what you wish for.
I know. But we should wait until I'm getting off, Sam.
Any other questions from the committee? We're looking to just accept the presentation. Can I get a motion, please?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Okay.
Thank
you.
We
do appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity to do the IRP for you. And appreciate your staff immensely.
Thank you. I think we're going to move forward with number two. We're going to push number three off to the next committee meeting.
Good evening. You have in your packet the quarterly review of the capital investment plan, the report on capital investments. I will give you some brief highlights on some of these projects quickly. The OPW2 on the first page of the general fund projects, the OPW2 site improvements, which is ST1504, is still being worked on. Mrs. Duca is working on a voluntary cleanup plan for the old waste or the OPW2 site on the soils. They're testing some soils, and she's working on a voluntary cleanup plan on that. The valve replacement at Silver Lake Dam has been completed. So that's one of the issues that we were trying to get resolved for the Silver Lake Dam. We do have in next year's budget the annual inspection that's required for that dam, so that is in next year's budget as well, so we'll keep up with that. The storage barn, while the invoice hasn't been paid yet, it is complete. They were pouring the concrete and asphalt this past week, I believe, so we should see that closed out here shortly. The Persimmon Park Place drainage study, they are talking with some of the customers, getting letters out. Mr. Neal has met with me and Ms. Dufo on that project. Let's see what else I got here. Several of the recreation projects, the Dover Park Master Plan is started up. We met with Mr. Hugg this last week. Some of this is started up, but none of those recreation projects will be completed. They're just getting started this year, so many of these projects have been moved to next year's budget, so you'll see them again next year. The money has also moved to next year's budget. So the Street and Alley program, as you know, is underway, and the Silver Lake Dam improvements, the bid documents came in, and they're working on getting that awarded. If we go to, I'm not going to go over the community transportation. They're along with the street program, so I'm going to skip to the electric projects. Most of these, you can see the staff's comments, the meter system upgrades. We're still working through that. That's a long-range project, several years. The Van Sant capacity increase, that is complete. The Horse Pond Road 69 rebuild, we're waiting the release of the final billing. That is complete. Town Point White Oak distribution feeders, that's in process. That is another multi-year project. The Van Sant exhaust plenum replacement is in process. That is just awaiting final invoices at this point, I do believe. Unit 3 stack repairs, of course, is complete. The 69 cable replacement on North Street. The engineering work has started. This was pushed out because of the DelDOT work going on there, so this was pushed out because of DelDOT needing to get their work done first. Horse Pond Road under ground feeders, distribution feeders, complete. Some of the new upgrades, Oak Grove Trailer Park, Dover East Estates, those are in process. North Street overhead to underground. This is another project that's being scheduled around DelDOT, I believe. Just trying to think of some of these major ones. The Meeting House Branch pole relocation, EE1710, that project will get moved out because we're still working on the cleanup of the PW2 and all the work that's got to go into that. This won't be done this year, so that'll be moved out. The rest of them, you can see that they're all in process. So I'm going to go to the Water Sewer Fund. The 1 million gallon elevated water storage tank, that's the tank where we've been having problems getting some land acquired for that tank. Sharon is actually reworking the water model, or they're getting ready to work the water model to see if that tank is still needed. We're going to determine whether it's still needed there or not, and so she's going to be working the model for that. The Westover pump station's in process. The Hazelville Road Interceptor is awaiting final retainage invoice, as well as the retreat pump station. The Roland Acres pump station is in process. weight and materials for the construction. The Delaware Avenue Sanitary Sewer is scheduled to begin. It was scheduled to begin in April. It should have begun by now. I'll have to check with Sharon on that. I don't think she started that yet. Go down here. The new fence at Well 6 was completed. All the rest of this year's projects, most of them are in process at some point. The Bradford Street survey was completed. And then these Deltec, all the pump station and the 17 wastewater projects down at the below of the schedule, they're all in process too. They're either in a design stage or they're in construction stage. So.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? All right. There is no action required. We're moved to number three. Item number three will be moved to the June 12th committee.
Move to adjournment.
And move to adjournment.
Second.
Second.
All right.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell.
Councilman Seller now call to order the Special Parks, Recreation, and Community Enhancement Committee. Agenda additions, deletions.
Move to accept the agenda.
Second.
Been properly moved by Councilman Anderson, second by Councilman Neal. All those in favor, please state by saying aye.
Aye.
Thank you. The ayes have it. We now move to item one, proposed resolution number 2017-07. Establishment of the City Community Sustainment Fund through voluntary contributions, sponsored by Councilman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As many of you know, we have an interesting and challenging environment around us. While the city's finances are in good shape, as attested by our bond rating upgrades and in other areas, we know that the state is having some challenges. The federal government has been claiming tight budgets for 30-some years. So you look and there's a reason that we have to look and say, hey, local people need to take care of local problems. We had a gentleman who testified, and instead of just complaining about the lack of resources to deal with some of the problems we have, made a suggestion. And he made a suggestion of a voluntary system where people could give a dollar and to make a difference. Now, the suggestion he made, of course, didn't have a mechanism to it. However, this is the mechanism to that suggestion. What this would do is it would provide us some insurance against federal cuts to the CBDG money, the Community Development Block Grant, and it would be, as you may know, there's a proposal to actually zero it out this particular time. I doubt that will happen. That's proposal's been made before, and it didn't happen. I doubt it will this time. However, I think with the particular dynamics that we have, that there will certainly be some measure of cuts, and probably cuts greater than the 5% that we've projected. So how we replace that money? One way would be to cut other programs that we need. Another would be to raise taxes. And I don't think either of those are viable options if it can be avoided. I believe that people in this community, if they understand what is available, what is being supported, would be willing to support it. We'd be willing to support their community. There's many good projects going on which are rebuilding our downtown, encouraging ownership, helping seniors repair houses instead of having them go and be or other people on very low incomes to repair houses, helping the homeless shelter, helping others. We've been able to help Serenity House rebuild. We helped save the Murphy School. Very worthy projects. And those wouldn't happen without this particular pool of money, unless and it therefore is worth securing. That's the why behind it. The next part is what is this particular proposal, and how does it work? What's being proposed is a negative checkoff type system, where essentially there would be a dollar for a difference, which would be added to the electric bill, or the utility bill would be a better way to say, electric water sewer. It would just be part of it, and if the person pays their bill, they would pay it, or it's a company or a nonprofit or whomever. It would just be there. Now, because it's voluntary, if a person's having a hardship, it's not going to, not paying that dollar is not going to count against them to have their services terminated. They also have the option of saying, you know, I just want to opt out of it. I don't want to participate for whatever reason. Won't be questioned about it. So that's the difference than a tax. By it being a negative checkoff, the benefit to that is that you don't have to think about it each and every month. It's something that you do unless you don't do it. And those type of systems have historically have shown an 80% compliance, but nobody knows how much it would be. If you had 10%, that would be enough to make up for if we had approximately 10 to 15% cut in the CBDG money. So it would be worth doing even if it had a relatively low participation, because it would offset cuts. If it had a higher participation, the higher participation could top out at around $300,000 a year. So it will probably be somewhere between $24,000 and $300,000. So you're going to have to run it about 6 months before you can even really understand how accepted it is in the community. So that's why we have to start it and not budget on it, but put it in place so that we can then, by the time our supplemental budget comes up around the beginning of the year, then we can look at, we'll know what the federal budget is. We know if there's extra money to maybe that for other charities to apply for, maybe the city programs such as our police athletic league or the mayor's commission on the homeless, and they'd be able to apply if, and the same criteria that we currently have, which is part of the beauty of this. Don't need to set up a criteria. We don't need to restart and think from the ground up. We just piggyback on the criteria we already have, the mechanism we already have to make awards, which is this committee, the point system that's done, the evaluation that's done professionally, all of those things, the application process, we have those already. There's no reason to redo them. There's no reason to restart them. There's no reason to spend money to get a consultant to do something else. We already know what we're doing. We already have it in place, and there's no reason to do anything differently. And that's part of the value of this. We have so there's no reason to reinvent the wheel. The pluses and minuses of this are that it's voluntary. It's a plus, but it's automatic. So therefore, until somebody checks out of it, they're in it. And so you have a reasonably steady and dependable stream of revenue. As I said, the typical negative checkoff compliance rates are reasonably high. If we communicate it, there shouldn't be a lot of drop-off. If people know what's going on, if it's not hidden from them, there shouldn't be much of a drop-off. The base for this is much broader than the property tax. And if you were to implement a property tax, you have a broader base because it is a base that is greater than the city, because you have people and businesses and the like which are outside of the city but are part of the city economy who would benefit from participating, because they happen to be in an area that's technically cut out, it doesn't mean that they don't face the same challenges that the city has, and they get city utilities. You also have the fact that just because an entity doesn't pay taxes, they still pay the utilities, so that would participate. So you have a broader base than you do with the property tax. The amount, plus the amount is very low, being a dollar, so that's not enough for most people to raise hackles. However, $12 a year, if you had 10,000 participants, which would be approximately a 40-some percent compliance rate alone, would raise about $120,000 a year. So you are talking about something significant. The minus is that it is unknown how effective it's going to be, because it hasn't been tried here. So no one can tell you what the effectiveness is going to be here until you do it for at least 6 months. But the good part is there's nothing to lose, because you are not setting up a new collection facility, you're not setting up new staff, you're not setting up new costs. You're using the existing mechanisms all the way around. Therefore, you're not losing money to do it. And therefore, you have nothing to lose in that regard. And unlike a tax, people, if they really can't afford it, they can make that decision to opt out. It's not going to take money away from somebody who just can't afford it, or stress somebody who already can't pay their bill. And that is how this particular system works. We're going to have very soon plans come up, and without something like this, all the work that's been done, all the study that's been done with commissions and Blue Ribbon commissions would likely go nowhere. With something like this, there's the potential that if a plan is evaluated to be effective, it could actually have some funds to address some of the deep-seated problems which are hurting our economy in the long run, can also be hurting our security and our community. It's a win-win proposal, and we have nothing to lose. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilman Anderson. Are there any questions from the committee? Council President Slavin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Anderson, for bringing this forward. I think there's possibly the kernel of a good idea in here somewhere, but I'm kind of a little confused about some things. First of all joking aside, your name's David Anderson, and you're promoting people donating their money to government to fund more programs, right? That's where we are on this? I just want to make sure I'm clear on that, because that is the first time I have heard that come out of your mouth. But I do appreciate the creativity with this, and I appreciate the fact that it was in response to someone there. I do have some concerns about, kind of the mechanics of how people would opt in and opt out. I mean, this is an administrative. This is going to cost something to collect money, right? It's going to be some programming fees on utility bills. There's going to be accounting fees. There's going to be a customer service impact for people who opt in, opt out, don't want to pay it anymore. How do they get that taken off their bill? They didn't know what it was going toward. I think there's also I'd like to have this conversation as part of the larger budget discussions and actions we're about to take on in the next couple of weeks. And I would recommend that we defer it to those budget hearings. But behind it all is a philosophical question, and it's one that state government is facing, and now we're facing, and county government is facing. And that is, are we willing to say we're going to absorb the cuts that are being passed on by the federal government? The president just released a budget which has steep and very deep cuts to many programs. And I don't believe it's going to be the place of the city of Dover to say, okay, therefore we'll take on those and we'll come up with new financing schemes where people donate their money to city government to do this. My own personal thing about donating money is I think that charity, it begins with the heart, right? Charity is a matter of the heart, and it should be left to the individuals to direct where they want to donate their money. I, for one, just as a personal preference, have never checked off a box on my income tax returns to give a dollar to any of those funds, because I simply don't believe they go to solve the problems that they say they solve. I think there are high overhead fees for a government to run funds like that, and I think there are better places for my money to go to. But I appreciate this. I think it might be something that we want to discuss under the budget. When the time comes, I'll make a motion that we defer to the budget discussions. But, thank you, Councilman Sutter.
Yes. Councilman Neal.
Yeah, I'm going to second the motion, but again, I want to applaud Councilman Anderson for a brilliant idea, an out-of-a-box idea. And again, I think it shows heart, and it shows out-of-the-box thinking to make something happen if other things are failing around us. My concern was that it seemed, if I remember correctly, and I can't see that over there, that not-for-profits were going to have to pay this. And I question that in itself. And the reason I second this motion is that I think it needs further discussion. And as Council President Slavin said, let's see what the mechanics are when we start talking about the budget going into a new fiscal year.
Now, was that a...
Councilman Lewis and then Councilman Lewis.
I don't think the proposal is a bad idea, and I commend Councilman Anderson for coming up with the idea, as long as it's kept voluntary. But I do have concerns also, as Councilman Slavin expressed, how we're going to manage it. And will there be fees to, you know, assist with that portion of it? So I, too, agree. I mean, I think it's an excellent idea, but I agree. I think we need to further discuss it.
Yeah. Councilman Anderson.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you. And thank you. Thank you, Councilman Neal. It is out of the box. And I think it's too often we are boxed in our thinking. And that's, and I think that's wrong. I personally have always believed that the best place to solve a problem is by the people who are closest to that problem. And I believe that localism is the new answer to globalism. Localism's where we started, and it's funny, we've come full circle. We're starting to understand that the only way we tackle problems is most efficiently, is not by some international movement or not by one size fits all, but by local people evaluating and keeping eyes on and solving local problems. One of the things that we've done very efficiently is when we've set up a already existing system. It's taken years to develop and to get to where we are with how we're running our community development block grant monies. And it sets up a mechanism where if we just put money into a fund, that's done already. How much does it cost to do that? That would be basically a pretty low cost. We already have fees that we have that are $1 here or $2 there on that bill would just be another one. However, now the question about now the non-taxpayers, whether or not that should be voluntary for them or not, that's something that I'm open to. I've passed this around in the community to a number of nonprofits and churches and other foundations, and none of them had a problem with it. They actually liked the idea, but because one, it is low, and two, philosophically, they tend to see themselves as community oriented. But it also not only does it non-taxpayers, but also any group that does a payment in lieu of taxes as well. So if they already make a voluntary contribution to the city, they could opt out too. So it really is voluntary all the way around. But if somebody wanted to adjust that, that's not to me, that's not a stumbling block. That's a very small part of the issue. But I would remind you that the base in the city is only about 60% is only our taxpayers. We have the city has approximately 40% of its value basis and customers and the like are non-taxpaying. So that is just something I would like to remind you if you do that, because you could be affecting some of the certainty, if you would, of revenue that would come in that wouldn't particularly be impactful. But that would be totally up to you. But I think it's valuable to begin this discussion now, because I think if we started it within a budget, there's a whole lot of other moving pieces within a budget in a budget hearing, and I think that this particular piece could get lost in that discussion if we do not begin it now. Because if we start it now, it's going to take us at least 2 weeks to go through it, and if we do delay it, then it's going to take even longer. But it's something that needs to be done, and I think it's something that in the long run has to be done. Because, quite frankly, we got off back in the day. We got off, in my view, 50 years ago, and we federalized everything. We local people need to take responsibility for local problems. And I think the people of this city, from what they tell me, and from marketing this out in the community for feedback, are willing to step up if we give them the chance.
Thank you, Councilman Anderson. Mr. Caldwell?
I think it's a good idea in the long run. When you think about it, it has a good plan. But I'm concerned about the administrative and the management of all of this activity and the money aspect and what it's going to cost in order to try to achieve all of this. And plus, I think we do have to have it in a budget meeting in order to go over the fine print of everything that has to take place within. So, good idea. I mean, I like to see people volunteer their time and their money, but I think there's a little bit more that we need to focus on that we're not really hearing at this point. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Caldwell. Committee members, you have heard Councilman Anderson's request. What is the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Just a minute. I think Council President, thank you. I move that we defer this matter until the budget hearings.
There's a motion on the floor. Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion?
Discussion.
Yes, Councilman Anderson.
I think while there's merit to that, I think it would be much better to refer this to staff for review. Because I think referring it to staff, you can answer the one question that you still have. Because you have answered every question except administrative overhead. And I think that's the question that can only be answered if referred to staff. We defer to the budget, and we're still going to have that same question a month from now. I think the staff can bring that recommendation, that answer to that question when they bring it forth in the budget. So that would be my recommendation.
Council President, statement.
Thank you. There's nothing that precludes, if we defer to the budget hearing, there's nothing that precludes staff from preparing some of those answers.
Okay, we have a motion on the floor. It's been properly moved by Council President Stamen to refer this matter to the budget for review. It's been properly seconded by Councilman Neal. All those in favor, please state by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those in nay, ayes have it. We'll now move to item number item two, proposed change in frequency. Community Development Block Grant, CDBG, program updates. Please state your name for the record, please.
I'm David Hugg. This is almost a housekeeping request. With the uncertainty in the Community Development Block Grant program and other demands on staff, it kind of seems unreasonable to do a quarterly report that says no action from the last quarter. So what I was asking was simply permission to do a biannual, or that's the right term, every 6 months, whatever that is, report, unless something significant changes.
I would like to defer that question to the Council President. In that matter, how should we proceed? Do we need to take a motion to vote to that request? Could you please give me guidance, Council President Slavin? Is there a motion to accept staff
so
recommendation?
So moved.
Moved by Councilman Cole, second by Councilman Anderson. All those in favor, please state by saying aye.
Aye.
Those nay, ayes have it. Thank you, Mr. Hugg.
Once we get all this straight, we may want to go back to the quarterly, because it's been valuable in the past to know where hang-ups were with the money, except
we'll certainly keep an eye on that. And if there are any issues that come up in the interim, we won't wait for 6 months to tell you, obviously. And if it looks like the CBDG program proceeds forward and gets funded and whatever, certainly look at coming back with a quarterly report.
Thank you.
David, Thank you. Honeymoon is over.
Well, I thought this went pretty well. I mean, so far tonight.
Okay, we now move to item three, adjournment of Special Parks, Recreation, and Community Enhancement Committee meeting. I will now accept the motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Been properly moved by Councilman Lewis, second by Councilman Anderson. Is there any discussion on the mat on the motion? All those in favor, please state by saying aye.
Aye.
All right, we are now adjourned.
I'm going to ask Councilman Lewis if he would chair the Safety Advisor and Transportation Committee as the ranking member.
Councilman?
All right.
I'm sorry. Look, we have to let Mr. Keller come down.
Yes.
And Councilman Lewis?
I was going to use my pen. I call the Safety and Advisory and Transportation Committee to order. Before we begin, are there any deletions or additions to the agenda?
I move to accept the agenda as presented, with any deletions or amendments to the agenda requested.
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Number one on the agenda is a proposed ordinance 217-07, amending Chapter 46, Fire Prevention and Protection, Article 2, Fire Department Division 2, Officer Section 4677-3, Election and Voting Regulations for Nominees, Eligible Voters. sponsored by Councilman Slavin and Councilman Hare. Chief Curry, I believe you're here to make that presentation or speak on that.
Good evening. Did everyone get a copy of the proposed?
Okay. Yes.
Recommendation is because, as you see in the past, probably close to 10 years now, how the voting list has really dropped because how our increase of calls. This was done many years ago, estimating back then 250 to maybe 500 calls a year, and now we're up to 1,300 we're averaging now a year. And alone for this year right now, our next call is 471. So we've had 470 already this year. And it's just a demanding for the young generation today is not as active back when my days the young generation, because now the demanding where they have to work two or three jobs because they can't find a full-time job, they got to work two or three part-time jobs. And so it's just hard to make the calls. Even we do have more calls, but it's still hard for them to make it. Because our average now for voting for the line officers average is about 25 to 30. I mean, it's dropped at least by 20, 25, because we usually have over well over 50 voters that can vote for the line officer part for the city.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions for Chief Curry? Oh. Councilman Ann?
Chief, just yes.
I'll yield. Okay, Council President Slavin.
You're going from a percentage to a raw number. Are you worried that it will swing the other direction, that as your call volume goes up, it'll be a very low number of calls that people will have to make to be eligible?
Yes, that will help out tremendous. Right. Because it's an average now, like now what we're doing, you almost got to have 170 calls to vote. Mm-hmm. So now where we studied this was a two-year study, and going back 10 years back, and seeing how much we've progressed on calls, because I'll give an example. When I started as a fire line officer in 1991, we were averaging 600, a little over 600 calls. When I came fire chief in 97, after that year was completed, that's when we hit 1,000, and we haven't seen anything under 1,000 since. In the last 4 years, the last 2 years out of the first two years, we went to 1,200, and now we're hitting 1,300.
Anybody else have any questions? Councilman Anderson?
Thank you. Thank you, Chief, for bringing this. I believe that it's a positive because it will encourage more involvement. But at 125 calls, wouldn't that be within the historical norms? So that wouldn't really be people responding to less calls than they did 20 years ago or 25, but that would be within historical norms,
right,
would it not?
Right. Right now would average out where they made at least two calls a week. We could have 20 calls this week. We might have 30 calls this week. It averages, anywhere from 20, 30 calls a week we're averaging easily.
So, how would this help more involvement with the fire department and would it do it this way?
Well, we've always had a percentage. The rule's always been you only vote if you ride a fire truck, not to somebody just sits back tomorrow yet now and drink coffee, because times change from back then to today. Yes, there's departments. Every member in there can vote no matter what position it is. We've never done that, and I'd never, ever see us wanting everyone to go that way or ask to go that route.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
I have one question.
Mr. Keller?
Has there been a concerted effort to recruit?
Oh, yes. We're on that process now. We're getting ready. I got over 2,500 pamphlets just made up, cost $1,800. Hopefully it pays off very well.
Right.
Getting ready to meet with Dell State and Wesley. I've already talked to the president of Wesley the last council meeting, previous one from last night. He's on board. My goal is every dorm is going to get a pamphlet. So he has over 900 dorms there. I haven't got with Dell State yet how many they got between the old Sheraton and the college, but if I have to get more, we're going to do it. And also, we're going to try, our goal is when the freshmen come in, we know there's out-of-staters. We've gotten some Wesley students before that's come from Pennsylvania, New York, and they've been outstanding kids that's come along, and we hate when they get done school and leave because they are a really good access force. Very good. We just lost one this past school year. He went on, moved on with his life, got his college degree, 4 years here at Wesley, and he was outstanding. And he was one of the top 20 guys' attendance. I mean, with school, just school and Firehouse, and he studied, stayed at Firehouse and studied. And that's a plus there where somebody's hanging out at the station where we have a BS call so we don't have to blow the fire whistle. Because half the calls, out of the 1,300 calls, we only blow the whistle like over 600, close to 700 times. Because the other ones, it's the duty officers checking it out, or there's a group of guys in there can go take care of that minor situation.
I just want to say, I think the city of Dover is very fortunate to have what we have.
Yeah.
Through the fire department. Just so fortunate.
Yeah. Nobody knows. I mean, with the survey, that still don't tell at all, because the outsiders that come in, like when Dover Downs was real large, 150, 70 people coming, 1,000 people for the race, how many outsiders would come visit us from all over the United States, and just it blows their mind how we're still running the volunteer fire department.
And you could walk into either firehouse and practically eat off the floor. Your equipment is in top-notch condition.
Yeah. Well, it's the safety for us and for everybody out in the public. And that's what we try to stress.
You've done a great job.
Because if it ain't no good for us, it's no good for the person who's calling for us.
And I hope you have success with the...
Yes, I hope so too, because we've tried we do it all the time with the high school, but today's time and kids.
I understand. And
we all know that situation. I know it with my job. Can't keep people.
All right. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Does anybody else have any other questions?
For acceptance. There's nobody else.
I'd just like to make comment. I would like to extend my appreciation to your department chief. You do a phenomenal job.
Thank you.
And that comes from the heart.
Thank you.
And thank you for your presentation tonight.
Yes. Now, I just want to thank council for all their support for the last few years since I've been back. Pulled me out of retirement to this. I know there's a struggle when I come back. Of course, I'm demanding too. But overall, I think things it's really improved for relationship-wise. We need you, and vice versa.
I hear you. Do I have a motion to accept proposed ordinance 2017-07?
Move to accept.
Second recommendation to pass.
Motion by Councilman Neal, second by Councilman Anderson. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Number two on the agenda is proposed resolution 2017-01, complete street policy. And we have Mr. Hug making that presentation. Just state your name for the record again, sir, if you don't mind.
David Hug, acting city planner. This matter came before you a month or so ago, I believe. It came out of the bicycle and pedestrian subcommittee of the safety committee. It's part of our plan to have Dover designated again as a bicycle-friendly community. What the resolution does is commit the city to participating in the Complete Streets program, and I should tell you that virtually all of the things we're dealing with are in our ordinances in some place, but they're not listed under a Complete Streets policy. They're kind of scattered. So this brings them together in one place. DelDOT has a Complete Streets program. We have all the components of the streets Complete Streets program. So what we're asking is that this resolution be adopted by council committing to that program.
Does anybody have any questions? Council President Slavin and then Councilman Anderson.
Thank you. I'm supportive of this. I was last time around. I would move it this time that we accept the proposed resolution number 2017-01.
Second.
The motion has been put forth by Council President Slavin and seconded by Councilman Anderson. Discussion?
Discussion.
Discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the discussion, I'd like to propose an amendment, and that is an amendment to page 2, line 30, just to remove and reduce this automobile dependency. It's not necessary to be in this resolution, and it's certainly not the role of the city government to try to get people out of the wonderful invention called the car. It's for us to provide options, and that's what this resolution is about, and that particular line makes it unnecessarily controversial, and I think takes it in a wrong direction. Removing that line makes this a pretty perfunctory and I think a reasonable resolution.
Councilman Neal.
I'll second his motion. His amendment.
Councilman Anderson has put in an amendment to this proposed ordinance, and Councilman Neal has seconded. All in favor?
Discussion, yes. Looking at 29 and 30, which says complete streets in Dover that achieve principles of connectivity, fosters walkable, bikeable, and transit-friendly communities, and reduces automobile dependencies. Well, I don't think that the nature of the resolution sort of implies that we're trying to get rid of vehicles. It also could be looked at, we're trying to make the environment more friendly due to, the combustion and the what comes out the exhaust pipe. I don't, it's a little, I see where you're coming from, Councilman Anderson, but I don't think that the spirit of this resolution was to decrease dependability on automobiles. I just think that it just, that, just trying to create different avenues. But I can see what you're saying. Mr. Hugg, what are your thoughts on that? I'd like to hear your thoughts in regards to the automobile, reduce automobile dependency.
I think the whole goal of, complete streets and multimodal transportation and what have you is to give people options so that they don't have to get in their car and drive to get a loaf of bread. That they can use public transit, that they can ride their bike, that they can walk and do so safely. So I think in that context, there is this notion that we provide an option and don't necessarily require that people be dependent on their automobile all the time. I don't believe it's a negative term. I think it's just a reflection that this whole program is intended to provide a set of options.
Final question. Do you think that maybe it should be something added to that to bring a little bit more clarity to the resolution in regards to your position? Or would you vote this down or would you vote this up?
Okay. No, I'm not going to tell you I don't think the striking of those three words in any way is a detriment to the resolution. I think it's implicit in the resolution that if you provide biking, walking, transit, all these other kinds of transportation and accessibility, kind of by default, you're making people less dependent on automobiles. I don't know that if you put a period after transit-friendly communities that this resolution is in any way weakened or has less value. So,
okay. Thank you for your honesty and thank you for your insight.
Does anybody else have any more questions? Hearing none, would somebody like to make a motion to accept proposed resolution?
Voting on the amendment?
Okay. Let me backtrack a bit. I'm new at this. Would somebody like to make a motion for the amendment that Councilman Anderson introduced?
We're just ready to call for a vote on it,
yeah,
Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Just call for a vote.
Call for a vote. I call for a vote. Who's in favor of this amendment?
Aye.
Aye.
Who's opposed?
No.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. Nay.
Okay, so I have two against, and let me have a roll call, please.
Mr. Anderson?
Yes.
Mr. Sedler?
No.
Mr. Neal?
Yes.
Mr. Lewis?
No.
Mr. Cole?
No.
No.
Mr. Poles?
No.
I'm sorry.
No.
So we have...
Mr. Keller?
Oh,
no.
Sorry. Mr. Hiles?
No.
All right.
Six to two.
The amendment fails.
Now we have the original motion to accept.
So I'd like to, could I hear a motion to accept the original proposed resolution 2017-01?
Call for a vote on the
already made.
Motion.
So just call the, call
okay,
the vote.
I call for a vote. Roll call.
Mr. Anderson?
No.
Mr. Sedler?
Yes.
Mr. Neal?
Yes.
Mr. Lewis?
Yes.
Mr. Cole?
Yes.
Mr. Poles?
Yes.
Mr. Sleeman?
Yes.
Mr. Keller?
Yes.
All right. The motion passes 6-2. Thank
seven,
you, Mr.
Seven
Hunt.
To one.
Thank
you.
Seven to one.
Oh, I'm sorry. Next on the agenda is quarterly update, bicycle pedestrian subcommittee. There's no action required. That's you again, Mr. Hogg?
That's me.
Okay. No action is required. It's in your packet. It's the quarterly report that my staff puts together for you know, for council and for the committee, and we're happy to provide it to you.
Does anybody have any questions?
Any questions?
Yes.
Mr. Anderson?
Thank you. I have a, Mr. Chairman, if you please direct us. I have a question regarding when it comes to the issue that was brought up with the safety issue for the new Westover connector in the bicycle and walking pedestrian crossing that wasn't. Is there any update on that from Bell Doctor? I don't
have an update on that, sir. I'm sorry, but I will try and find out for you. I know the issue was brought forward. There's really two issues involving the Westover connector. That's one of them, and connecting access to a parcel near the end of the road is another issue that had been brought back to their attention.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's my only question.
Okay. Anybody else have any questions?
Move acceptance of the report if necessary.
Councilman Neal has moved to accept the report. Do I hear a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Passes unanimously. Number four on the agenda, adjournment of Safety Advisory and Transportation Committee. Do I hear a motion?
Council Chair, before we adjourn, I have a...
You're making this difficult for
statement.
Me, sir.
you know, we got to get some used to it. So I just want to say that I did receive a concern from one of my constituents, Francis Bethel, who lives on, I think, 120 Ann Avenue, in regards to excessive traffic speeding on Ann Avenue. We asked for speed bumps. I did let him know we no longer provide speed bumps, but he wants to look at an alternative. I did let him know that I would pass his concern on to the Safety Advisory and Transportation Committee. I will also provide in writing his concern to be placed on the agenda for next meeting, and possibly have him to come and voice his concern personally.
Okay.
Thank you.
Councilman Sudler, duly noted. Now, do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Motion made by Councilman Sudler, second by Councilman Neal and Anderson. We are adjourned.
All right.
Move to adjourn, rise, and report the committee of the whole.
Second.
Moved by Councilman Anderson, second by Councilman Sudler. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Stand adjourned. Thank you, gentlemen. Good job.